And the next slide then is slide 28. So this now dives into exploring the context of power and the therapeutic relationship. So remember, this is kind of the third component of knowing thyself. So first of all, just knowing how the client is viewing you. So it's going to be a constant that in the therapeutic context, you're going to have more power than your client has. So there's always going to be that power differential. But understanding in a more detailed way what it is, in what way you have more power, or how you are viewed by the client can be helpful, I think. So are you viewed as the expert? Are you viewed as highly educated? And it might be both or neither. It might be something else. But understand specifically what type of power your client is perceiving in you, kind of how they are interpreting the power differential. And this can be done even through just a meta conversation about therapy. And I've seen this done before, heard about this done before, where a therapist will have a discussion with a client and say, well, it seems like you are viewing me as the expert, an expert that you're coming to for advice. Right? So a related notion is transference, so how the client is viewing you. And acknowledge the inherent power differential in psychotherapy, keeping in mind where you're located in the power structures of your own culture and community, where you're at there, and also where the client is located. So there might be, kind of going back to this idea of privilege, there might be aspects of your identity where you are less privileged than your client or more so. So keeping track of that and being careful about how that might impact therapy. Asking yourself how use of power might be affecting your therapeutic decision making. How a power differential also might affect the welfare of the client. Knowing that being in a position of power can mean that sometimes we are, again, blinded. So privilege blinds. And we also need to remember that power blinds. And so there's been research that, different lines of research that have demonstrated this, I think. So one is that, and if you look at number 6 on the slide, in the title of the paper, which says it all pretty much, is situational power and interpersonal dominance facilitate bias and equality. So basically, just by being in a position of power relative to your client, you are vulnerable to becoming more biased and doing something which perpetuates an inequality or is a microaggression. It's just something that you become vulnerable to, mostly because you become blind to what you're doing. So that's important to remember. Privilege blinds, also power blinds. Also remember, and this was actually on a practice test for the ECCC a few years ago when I took it, and it made me smile. I was glad to see it. But the finding that those in positions of power are less attuned to those who have less power, so they're less good at reading them, and subordinates are more attuned to those with power. So what this means is that being in positions of power as therapists, we're vulnerable to falling into this false belief that we can read our clients really well, that we know exactly where they stand with things, that we know when they're offended, we know when therapy's working, we know when we had a good session with them, and we know when we're connecting with them. When, in fact, research does not indicate this, and this is why David Burns has come up with end-of-session assessment tools or evaluations to actually ask clients, especially new clients, how the therapy session went, if they felt connected, if they felt judged or not judged, if they felt like the methods were helpful, to actually ask about these things, because what's been found is that therapists overestimate how helpful that they're being, and they don't tend to be able to pick up on subtle cues that there's something going on, maybe that's compromising the therapeutic alliance. And this is super scary, and I think it should be scary to us as therapists to know about this, and it, of course, linking back to this finding that, in general, those in positions of power are just less attuned to those who are in lower power positions. So we need to not assume, take for granted that we can read our clients. We need to know that our power in that relationship actually compromises our ability to do that compared to, you know, the way we might be with our best friend or something. And, you know, that finding about people being in less power being more attuned to those who have more power makes logical sense if you think about, maybe think about a romantic relationship that has a huge power differential in it, where you have one partner who is abusive and completely controlling, who holds all the power. Or maybe in the instance of an abusive home with children. What I've heard multiple times is that the children or the partner who is in a position of less power is very, very attuned to the person who is in more power. They know slight behavioral changes or mood changes they can pick up on. For abused children, it's sad and tragic, but they can tell before the parent becomes abusive that it's probably going to go that way. And sometimes the cues are extremely subtle, but they're very, very attuned to it, whereas the person who has more power doesn't really need to be attuned to the person who has less power because they have more power. So it kind of makes sense that just due to necessity and being able to function in different power dynamics, you know, it does make sense that if you have more power, you're just going to be less attuned because you can get away with it. So these are just things to keep in mind about power. Also, remember the power is different than privilege. So with privilege, we're talking about unearned assets, usually things that you're born with, that you don't need to really pay attention to, that you're blind to. Power can be related to privilege, just in that those who have more privilege tend to get into positions of power more easily. So these are not, they're related, but they're not terms that can be exchanged for one another. Power is usually more context dependent. Although privileged groups, again, overall compared to marginalized groups, are gonna have more power. And just like with privilege, our identity in terms of how powerful we are is nuanced and it varies by context. So just getting to know ourselves in that way too is good. Okay, so going to slide 29, identifying when a microaggression has occurred. So this is the third step. So you're culturally competent, you're always learning, and you know yourself really well inside and out. You have a pretty good grip on your biases and you're addressing them and you're sensitive and you're careful. Next step is to identify when a microaggression has occurred. How do you do that? I've listed three good ways to do that. So first of all, if a client seems to react negatively to something you said, that's a clue. And I know that's very common sense. Collecting outcome data, such as the Burns end of session evaluation, can be helpful. That'll tell you. If the client feels they could be honest with you, that could clue you in that something is not going well in the relationship and that it could be due to a microaggression. And also, if it's the case that there's something that you said that you're kind of questioning, you're wanting to know if it came off wrong, one technique can be to apply that same statement or that same sentiment to a dominant group or to a non-marginalized group or a group that holds more privilege in society. So if you go to the next slide, slide 30, you'll see an example of this, and this can be quite humorous, although then it's actually pretty sad what's underneath, that the fact that it looks so normal when it happens to women. But this is from a Twitter account that a man has started that highlights just some of the ridiculous advice or statements that are said to women. And what he does is he applies them toward men to highlight just how ridiculous they are and that they're essentially microaggressions. So the example here is, don't get me wrong, I'm absolutely fine with dads who work. It boosts their self-esteem and gives them an identity beyond just dad. So this is an example of something that's commonly said to women And so what you do is you take out the female identity and you insert the male identity, and you see, does it look weird or funny? And that can be a clue that a microaggression has occurred if you apply it to some other group and it seems bizarre. So we never see anything like this. Don't get me wrong, I'm absolutely fine with dads who work. Well, yeah, because it's assumed that it's fine, the dads work. The fact that you're even saying that is implying that maybe it's not okay, or there'd be a reason to think that it's not okay. Other examples of this from this guy's blog is wife back on the PlayStation, kids asleep. This is your time to relax. Did you know that ironing can help you de-stress and de-bloat? Another one is 25 bottom-heavy working dads reveal how they found their body confidence despite their figures. Another one is today's question. Should men be encouraged to have babies earlier? And by the way, there is research indicating that there is a ticking clock for men, but we don't really talk about that much. Another one is, an exhausted and emotional dad isn't going to be effective in any part of his life. Try to relax and focus on looking after yourself, too. And the last one is, I'm so lucky. My wife babysits for me once a week and empties the dishwasher when asked. Yes, we do both work, but she's a bit useless, to be honest. And you can see when that kind of common kind of attitude or mentality is applied to men, it's actually really insulting to men as well. You know, to think of men, to infantilize men and men as being worthless and needing to be handheld through everything. So these are all examples of statements that are geared toward women that are microaggressions, but it's hard to recognize them as microaggressions because we see them so frequently. It's not until we apply them to men that we realize that they're microaggressions. So again, if something seems odd when applied to the dominant group, that is an indication that a microaggression has occurred. But now going to slide 31, I would say, and I'm sure many of you are thinking, that the best way to know if a microaggression has occurred is to actually ask. So remember, we're not going to be good mind readers. We have too much power to be as good at picking up signals as we are with people who share the same amount of power with us. And remember that privilege blinds. And so if we commit a microaggression, we may not actually know it. So how do we know? We ask. And then I have a couple of points down here that just encourage this. One of them is avoidance of sensitive topics, for instance, about race, is a, quote, conspiracy of silence, according to Sue. To combat microaggressions, we must make the invisible visible. Otherwise, we let unintentional racism, sexism, heterosexism, etc. continue. So making the invisible visible, one way to do that is we just talk about it. We ask. We ask how something we said was perceived by that person. Other point here is when we are fearful about addressing the meaning of tension-filled interactions, offenses will be invisible. And as psychologists, we know better than to be fearful about difficult dialogue or tension-filled interactions, as he puts it. So, how do we know? We ask. Going to slide 32, addressing microaggressions. So this is about repairing the tear if we're the ones who committed them. Some recommendations is to rehearse responses using the 5 Secrets of Effective Communication by David Burns. So his steps are, and this is just how to deal with difficult situations that come up in therapy in general, but I think it can be applied to microaggressions really easily. First of all, to paraphrase the patient's words. So this is thought empathy. So repeat to them what you heard them say. Acknowledge his or her feelings is the second step. So feeling empathy. So this should be really super common sense for us. The next one, though, is something that I think can be challenging sometimes, and that is find the truth in what the patient is saying. So this is the disarming technique. This may be very difficult if we don't see it in the way that the patient does, and we might want to jump to, like I was saying earlier, cognitive restructuring or something where we're trying to kind of help the the client see things differently or talk them out of interpreting things as they did, minimizing their experience. Instead, we really need to find the truth in what they're saying. This goes back to believing them. Fourth step is gently probing for more information, so inquiry. Learning more about, for instance, what they think maybe the hidden message was in a microaggression, especially if we're having a hard time identifying it as a microaggression, but they seem upset by something that we or someone else did. Figure out how they're interpreting it. What are they hearing? You know, there's what we might have said, but there's also what they're hearing. And this can be a difficult process. It's not as easy as you might think. It might take a 20-minute discussion to really get to the bottom of, okay, what did that statement really say to you? Fifth step is expressing warmth and compassion. So Burns refers to this as stroking. So we want to be empathetic. We want to be genuine. And finally, to share your reaction. So using I feel statements, being honest. So I think it's okay in a lot of contexts if you feel ashamed to actually say, I'm ashamed that I said that. And I didn't want to convey that message to you. Of course, keeping in mind that while it's good to express remorse and what your intention was, you don't want to turn it around to where now that's the focus of conversation. Because remember that is that reassertion of dominance that we want to avoid. So acknowledging that the intentions were not negative, but then really turning the focus back and keeping the focus on the client and the way they experienced it and what the impact is on them. So it's a little bit of a kind of a balance to walk. Now, if somebody steps back on your foot accidentally, that is a whole lot better than if somebody walks up to you, looks you in the eye, and stomps on your foot on purpose. So that's a whole lot worse. But if someone accidentally stomps on your foot, you know, steps back or something, or is even pushed and falls back on your foot, then it's good to hear, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to do that. But if they went on and on and on about how they didn't mean to and how you should accept the fact that they didn't mean to, and if that's the focus of the conversation instead of, you know, getting you to the ER because your foot is now broken, then that's really insulting. So I think that's maybe a good example for how we would want to handle these situations as they come up in therapy. So we can acknowledge that it's not intentional, but then really turn the focus back to, you know, the stroking, the inquiry, the disarming, the feeling empathy, the thought empathy, and be willing to face our own discomfort in these conversations and be careful about shutting them down. The citation that I listed here is Feeling Good Together, The Secret to Making Troubled Relationships Work. So yet again, this is actually a self-help book, something that we would normally use with clients, but that can be helpful in applying to ourselves. Additional recommendations for repairing the tear, sharing with them how you can make it different or maybe what you're going to do different in the future. Ask for future feedback, and this is a great thing to do, but it can be, just know that it can be difficult, I think, for clients as well, to ask them, if this comes up again, if you see me do something like this again, will you alert me? And that's really them doing you a favor, ultimately, but it also then allows you to intervene before any more damage is done. So if you have a strong relationship to begin with, and there's some chance that they'd be willing to do this. And if not, and it just seems like things are too ruptured, of course, our ethics code would tell us to make sure that we refer them to someone who might be able to be more helpful. And finally, following up is the last step. So if possible, try not to make it this kind of thing where it comes up once and then it's shoved under the rug and it never comes up again. That said, you don't want to dwell on things, especially when these clients are coming in with their things, their own agendas and things that they really need to talk about and work on. And this may not be something that they feel a need to focus on a whole lot. But I think showing that you care through at least following up once or twice about it can be good. Making sure that nothing else has come to mind since it first happened and the two of you first worked through it. Just being open to any new insights or any other thoughts that they might have, because all of us have had the experience where we leave a situation and then more thoughts come to us or different interpretations, or we think of other things to say. And so we want to give the space and give permission and make sure that clients know that it's safe to continue talking about these topics if they want to. And again, just communicating that we care. Slide 33. Continuing repairing the tear, to forgive yourself, understand the root of your defensiveness. I think the root of most of our defensiveness is caring, and we all are in this profession because we care. I don't know many people who became clinical psychologists because they wanted to become millionaires. We're here because we actually care about people, and so if we commit a microaggression and we know that that's harmful, that goes against who we see ourselves, right? It goes against our identity, against a main core value that most of us hold, and that can lead to defensiveness. So the root of defensiveness oftentimes is caring, is compassion for other people, but it can turn dark when it turns into defensiveness. So be willing to forgive yourself and understand the root of your defensiveness, but also understand, again, that intention does not equal impact, and being defensiveness is not an excuse for shutting down the conversation or not doing the personal work on yourself that needs to be done. A couple of other quotes here, or bullets at the bottom of the slide. One is, the simple act of naming a bias as such or objecting to it on the spot establishes a social atmosphere that discourages it. Saying nothing serves to condone it. So this is just motivation for repairing the tear, making sure that we address microaggressions as they come up. And secondly, from Safran and Moran, successful resolution of ruptures can create a, quote, emotionally corrective experience. So knowing that when there is a rupture, when we have made errors in therapeutic context, addressing them can help the client heal, can help us grow. It can be good for everybody all the way around. So it's good to do this. In slide 34, outside the therapy room, what can we do to increase visibility? So I've added a few things here. Consulting with, confiding in trustworthy colleagues, getting to know people who are different from you, so engaging in experiential reality. Keeping on learning, like I've said, so prioritizing ongoing personal and professional development. Practicing ongoing self-awareness and vigilance regarding biases, power, privilege. Reading about these topics, staying connected with your own identity. Remembering CBT, so remembering cognitive behavioral techniques that we know, so and applying them to ourselves, such as challenging our own biases, practicing disarming techniques, as Byrne would recommend, remembering communication techniques, and I added a website down here, Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith's website. She's a clinical psychologist in Northern California. She was one of my professors in graduate school, but she, on her website, actually talks about ways to be an advocate. And the next slide, continuing on with that, is to be an advocate and an ally. Speak up when you see microaggressions occurring. If you have the power to shape or change or even overhaul policies and procedures that might encourage microaggressions, definitely do. And the last recommendation that I put here is building your emotional intelligence. And I think this topic repeatedly made me think about emotional intelligence, probably because I teach workshops on EQ. And I think building EQ is a great way to really help reduce microaggressions. So if you're building your EQ, you first are building self-awareness, So the way you do this in this context would be, again, going back to understanding your identity, power, and privilege. Second aspect of emotional intelligence is affect regulation, so emotion regulation. So if you're applying this to the topic of microaggressions, this is about managing and regulating shame, guilt, and defensiveness. Then the third part is social awareness or interpersonal sensitivity. And this would be like reading other people's reactions, kind of knowing what tends to be offensive to people or what hidden messages tend to be. And finally, relationship management is a core component of emotional intelligence. And applied to microaggressions, this would mean meta communication about microaggressions, repairing ruptures when they occur, and effectively discussing difficult topics. And I put reference to a book, Emotional Intelligence 2.0, a book on how to build emotional intelligence that I found to be really helpful. So know that if you work on increasing your EQ overall, that this could also help you identify and address microaggressions more. Now going to the last slide, please feel free to contact me with any additional questions. For these sorts of topics, I know discussion can be the most fruitful part, so I hope to be presenting this in live seminars and workshops to make it a little bit more rich. If you would like to request a presentation or a workshop on microaggressions, feel free to contact me, or really just for any questions about the content or microaggressions in general. Thank you.